Thank you very much, Brad. There's been some challenging numbers and thoughts there. And what I'd like to do is open up to the floor now for questions and let Brad comment on some of those things. We've got 15, 20 minutes. We can go through that, and then we'll wrap up the formal part of our session here right now. So I'll throw it open to the floor and let Brad take your questions one at a time. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Kyle Coleman. I'm a professor at the University of Ottawa. Also, family and sex researcher, and I'm here with my graduate student. We're opening up a family media unit, and study at Boston was very concerned about keeping a couple of cats in the bedroom. One thing about corporate Canada, but God, if you keep them cats in the bedroom, you want to keep the family going. So, what about, because I've read your report,
right,
that came in the State of the Union,
right,
and we're talking about one of these major predictors of having a very satisfying sexual,
sure,
relationship.
Right.
So how do we bring corporate Canada and the state
Great question. How do you get corporate Canada in the bedroom alive in the right kind of way? Well, as you know from that report, one of the things that we found in the report, or I should say three things that we found in the report, was that what happens outside of the bedroom is very important for predicting sexual satisfaction in marriage. So fostering more commitment, fostering date nights, fostering communication, fostering even in the case of the States, a bit more domestic equality with guys helping out more in the household. All these things are linked to more satisfying sexual relationships for married parents in the U.S. So these are some of the kinds of things that are not as controversial directly that have implications, though, for sexual satisfaction. Those are the kinds of things that could be embodied in advertising campaigns, for instance, like, you know, pushing like the value of a date night, for instance, for couples that might be helpful. Beyond that, I've not thought a lot about how companies could foster could foster high levels of sexual satisfaction. But I should say, too, once again, that even on this question of sexual satisfaction, that we know that couples, generally speaking, looking in the emotional department, are more satisfied in their relationships when they're in married, faithful relationships compared to cohabiting relationships, compared to dating relationships, especially compared to ones where they're engaged in multiple concurrent partnerships. So the point there simply is that even in sort of this question of sexual satisfaction, that it's still the case that sort of promoting ethic of marital monogamy is also good on average for adults in this department too.
I talked to some university students that graduated from high school with access to 4 or 5 showings of like alcohol, environmentally, etc. I'm wondering how spiritual are something else to have or be modeled for these with respect to children, because they view them as environmental preservation and global warming.
Well, I think that concern about the impact of kids on the environment is certainly a salient one for some people. But I have to say, at least looking at the data in the States, I think it's more of an elite concern than it is a kind of mass concern, because we've actually seen an uptick in kind of the ideal family size in the U.S. to about 2.6. So people are having right now about 2 kids per month on average in the U.S. But if you ask them what kind of their ideal family size, it's about 2.6 kids. And it's slightly up since the 1970s. So kind of that concern about the impact of kids on the environment has not kind of filtered its way down into at least people's ideals when it comes to family size. So.
In your report, you showed the demographic results, I would say, for China and then the one for India.
Correct.
I assume Canada and the U.S. are probably more of the Chinese consumer involved in mid-later ages.
Yeah, that's correct. So we have on pages 2 and 3 of the report, different demographic pyramids for China and for India in 2030 to give you a sense of kind of where they're headed. You can see that India is still headed for some substantial growth after 2030, whereas as China is headed for, at least based on the population pyramids, some declines in population. Frankly, I would say that the U.S. is a bit closer to India and Canada is a bit closer to China. But what sort of the key kind of modifier there for Canada is that you have, you know, received a pretty large inflow of immigrants, you know, in recent years, And as that inflow continues, that will kind of mitigate the, you know, the effects of having a below replacement fertility rate of about 1.7 in Canada, you know, for you know, many years now. So, but the question too becomes for Canada, I think, is that a lot of immigration has come from Asia, and given at least the trends in East Asia, some of that push may, you know, from East Asia into Canada in terms of immigration may be coming down as the population of adults in places like China and South Korea and Japan, Taiwan, you know, shrinks because they've had such low fertility rates now for about 20 years or so.
But each of the classes of the appropriate family policy in the Indian society, basic things. And we just mentioned that the back moral and some of these you were introduced to talking about some of the events you've spoken at. How do politicians respond to these basic 10 ideas that seem to make a lot of sense on paper?
Well, I think on the one hand there is a recognition that demographics poses serious challenge to many countries, you know, places like Italy, for instance. But there's also obviously a sense of limitation, you know, real fiscal limits that they're now running up against, in part because of these demographic shifts that we're now running into. So on the one hand, I think there's a desire to create a context in the part of at least some MPs that is more family friendly. But there's also a question about where the money is going to come from to help, you know, pay for these kinds of programs. So it's so we have, for instance, you know, a discussion about in page 21 about a generous Finnish home care allowance, which allows parents to use money from the state to place their child in daycare or to raise their child at home or place their child in the care of a, you know, of a grandparent. And it would work out to, I think, around $2,000 in at least in U.S. money per child. Now, this kind of thing is harder to sort of make the case for in many countries, given their own fiscal, you know, constraints. But so it's a kind of question about, you know, how much can we spend on, you know, on this challenge facing us. Sort of this dilemma is what I've encountered. Well, that's a great question. So what can companies do internally? I think part of it, we've seen, for instance, in studies from IBM. Now, not every company has this ability, but IBM has been pushing a lot of flexibility in terms of scheduling with their employees and allowing employees to do a lot of work from the home, you know, when possible. And they've actually saved a lot of money in office space because they've, you know, they've got less folks working in formal offices and more working in home or, I think this might be, in Starbucks. But they've also seen in looking at the effects of this on the families of IBM employees is that sort of the work-life tension has decreased and their family life satisfaction has increased. So one thing that I think can be done for certain kinds of jobs and certain kinds of companies is to foster a more flexible working environment that allows people to set their own hours and work in their environment, as long as they're maintaining a certain level of productivity for the company. And of course, it doesn't work for every industry. If you're manufacturing, for instance, an automobile, you can't have people doing that at home. But it is an option, I think, for some companies, and they can be, I think, intentional about doing that. But it's also the case, too, that there are things that companies can do, like provide some level of relationship skills training that will be applicable to employees across the spectrum, be they married, collaborating, or whatnot, but that will redound to the benefit of families. And also things, too, like, for instance, help with budgeting and with finances, that couples who have received a good, you know, basic training in budgeting tend to do better as a couple, of course, also on the financial front as well. So there's some things like that, I think, at the margins where companies may not be able directly to target married couples, but they can provide services that will be helpful to married couples in ways that would be helpful for the quality of their married lives, and stability of their married lives.
I'd like to ask a number of
like questions, or I guess I'm hard enough to enjoy writing, so. Not in my conscription condition depression. But I wonder if you have studied the parameter of the fear that young men in their 20s and 30s now have to get involved in marriage because they so many of the elder people get divorced.
Yeah.
Lost out.
Right, sure.
Sure. So I wonder if this phenomenon has this part of any influence on the benefits of.
That's a great question. Actually, I don't know the nature of divorce law here in Canada, but I do know that in the United States, we have seen that young adults who have seen their own parents get divorced are more likely to cohabit, and they're more likely to get married, you know, in the second place, because they're fearful both of kind of the emotional and the financial consequences of divorce. So there's a kind of way in which the long arm of divorce really throughout the West seems to be a pretty marked increase in cohabitation. And that's indicative in part of the fact that couples have a more, their faith in marriage has been undercut by the divorce of their own parents or their uncle and aunt or their friends. And they think that by cohabiting they can kind of hedge their bets a bit. So I think that's part of the story here. One response I think that some states in the U.S. are beginning to consider is to draft divorce legislation that would take into account a bit more of people's investments in the marriage and take this into account when it comes to allocating property in the wake of a divorce, in part for reasons of justice, but also in part to send a signal to people that the investments that they make in their marriage are, you know, are to be respected. And that is that we might in some ways then foster a greater faith in marriage than we currently do in the U.S. Is that what you're getting at, or something else?
Yeah, the second part of the question was, was there any study from the statistical point of view on that reason, on whether this could be a reason or a parameter that has a significant influence on the statistics?
Well, it is the case that young adults in the U.S. who have seen their parents get divorced are more likely to not get married, and they're more likely to cohabit and have kids in a cohabiting relationship. So that certainly is pretty clear in the evidence. Is there some other specific question that you want me to address in terms of the science beyond that fact? Okay. Yeah, the impact. If you email me, I can, or through Dave, I can give you a specific figure from the States. So,
yeah. You were talking before about the kind of love marriage baby carriage, and I think right now what's happening is it's love, it's baby carriage, and then marriage.
Right.
Your
right.
Ultimate proof of love is having a kid or two kids.
Sure. Certainly in Quebec, I think that probably be the case to a certain degree. It's certainly the case in Sweden to a large degree right now, and it's certainly the case in the working class and poor communities in the U.S. What we often see is that people they'll have their kids in their 20s with someone or some people, and then they will get married to someone else entirely in their 30s after they've all settled down. And they feel like they're mature enough and they've got enough financial stability in their 30s to go ahead, at that point in their view, and get married. But the point that we're, I think, both sort of getting at in part here, too, is that in the mind of the public at large, to a great extent, marriage has become a kind of a soulmate model. You know, it's about finding your best friend, that person you really connect with, and also having a certain degree of financial stability beneath you as a couple. And it's not seen in the mind of the public as that closely connected to being a parent with someone. And so kind of our understanding of marriage has become just focused on the dyad rather than sort of seeing it as part and parcel of a number of goods, including romance, but also children, mutual aid, economic cooperation, you know, et cetera. Yes, ma'am.
I think if there's any statistics, how many always find it interesting when people say, precisely, well, my parents are divorced, I don't want to get married, and but they will cohabitate. In fact, they'll cohabitate with several different persons.
Sure.
So there's a little bit of an irony, in a sense, because in fact, he's been unofficially divorced three times, not once.
Right.
No one
right.
Look at the
sure.
Past. And I just wonder if there's any studies that have taken a look at that side of things, of the how many cohabitating relationships the average American can lose if they're not still in the marriage.
Well, we know that cohabitation in the States is becoming less stable, and so people are, and also people are cycling through more partners over the course of their life. We don't have kind of like the latest number on what that amounts to, but the sort of the trajectory is towards less stability and more partners. And what's interesting too is that in Sweden, we just kind of held up as a kind of like the Quebec, if you will, of Northern Europe, where cohabitation has a lot of status, both legally and culturally. Even in Sweden, cohabitation is a less stable relationship than is marriage. So kids who are born to a cohabiting couple in Sweden, about 75% more likely to see their parents break up by the time they turn 12 compared to kids who are born to married couples in Sweden. And I haven't seen data on Quebec, but I suspect there'd be a similar story where even in Quebec, there's less stability there for kids and couples than there is for kids and couples who are doing it through the marriage route.
Yeah. Other questions?
Are there examples around the world countries that have reversed this very low fertility and what policies may have led to that?
Well, that's a great question. So the question is, are there countries that have been able to kind of pull out of this low fertility scenario? And even the U.S. actually would be an example in some ways of that, because in the 70s, we had a TFR of about 1.7, and now we're back to about 2.0 right now. So I don't think it's the case that any trend, be it fertility or marriage, is necessarily going to travel in one direction, you know, indefinitely. And I think it depends both on the political process, the economic scene, and the culture, you know, to sort of push things in one way or another. And that's, of course, what we're all about, is trying to push these kinds of trends in the right direction. We haven't had a great deal of success, frankly, in Europe and the Americas. But one of the points to the report is to suggest that as we become cognizant, for instance, the fact that the welfare state does tend to depend upon, you know, generally speaking, some growth in the working age population to kind of give us more taxpayers to pay into that system, if that ceases to happen, it can, I think, create potentially an intellectual crisis for proponents of, you know, in this case of small families, because they're clearly not sustainable, that model, when it comes to keeping welfare state going, which they tend to be pretty keen on in other respects. So my point simply is that these new challenges that are facing us, both socially and economically, may give us an opportunity to say, well, look, you know, this contemporary family model doesn't serve our economy very well, doesn't serve the state very well. Maybe we need to rethink our approach to the family in ways that are more, you know, consistent with, I wouldn't call it a traditional model, but might call it kind of a natural model of one that welcomes kids and sees marriage as an important anchor for the family.
Any last questions? Oh, thank you. Over here.
Is there any chance that this demographic time bomb could affect the radioactive issue of abortion?
Well, that's lots of tough questions here.
These are people. This is good, eh?
Well, that's a tough question. I think we haven't seen that, and we're not likely to see that, I think, yet in Europe, or most of Europe and the Americas. Where it has actually emerged, though, is in Russia, where they've had such problems with fertility and mortality. Russia is one of those countries where they're seeing a real decline in population size, you know, every year. Same thing is true in Japan. And pretty dramatic declines too. And so they're looking, basically all policy options are on, you know, are on the table there in Russia because of what's happening there. And so they have begun to revisit their abortion laws in Russia with a view in part to try to bring the Russian fertility rates back closer to replacement. So, and this goes back to this question from the gentleman over here, that sometimes these demographic realities can be so powerful that they
they begin to challenge the kind of conventional elite wisdom about how we should structure our law and our culture when it comes to family life. So the Russia would be one case today that suggests that if things go so low when it comes to fertility and it comes, in this case, so high when it comes to mortality, that you know these demographic shifts can be so dramatic that, that countries are beginning to rethink their approach to family life.
Thank you so much.